Welcome.
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 You're listening to Built by Us.
Built by Us.
Built by Us.
Built by Us.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to a new episode of Built by Us by Democracy NC. I'm Zainab, a Democracy Summer Communications intern and a student at UNC Greensboro studying studio art and rhetoric and public advocacy. Today, we're joined by Yathrib Abdelgader to talk about first-generation immigrants and their civic engagement and activism experiences. In this episode, we'll be discussing what it means to be a first-generation immigrant during a time of intense social change within the U.S. We'll be sharing what it's like to grow up between two different cultures, the importance of being civically engaged, and the associated challenges, and what the future looks like for immigrant changemakers. We'll learn all about this through the experiences of Yathrib and myself. Yathrib is a refugee community organizer working with Church World Service Greensboro. She was born in Sudan and her family immigrated to the U.S. when she was just 3 years old. Yathrib has spent her life in Greensboro, NC, where she also attended UNC Greensboro and completed a master's degree in sociology to better understand and expand on her ideas of local and global social change. She has spent her time in the Triad connecting with the refugee and immigrant community through different avenues, and in her free time, she enjoys taking walks, reading memoirs, and watching mindless and easy-to-follow TV shows. First, let's get some definitions out of the way. According to the Immigration Initiative at Harvard, first-generation immigrants are those who were born outside of the U.S. 1.5-generation immigrants are those who came to the U.S. as children, including my guest, Yathrib. Second-generation immigrants are those who were born in the U.S., but have foreign-born parents. This includes myself. The differences between these generational statuses and even more terms, such as first-generation American, does get quite nuanced. For the purposes of this episode, we'll use each term accordingly and add in context when needed. Now we'll be hearing from our guest and learning why she is motivated to be part of the movement and what perspectives she feels that she brings to the table.
The first question is, coming to the U.S. at a young age, you essentially had to grow up between two very different cultures. What was that experience like for you? And how would you define the terms first-generation immigrant or first-generation American? And which one do you think fits you best?
Thank you. So kind of like I mentioned earlier, my family did come to the U.S. from Sudan in February of the year 2000. At that time, I was 2 years old. I was turning three in 2 months, but I just say that I was three. And so I did come here very young. And I think a lot of times growing up and even now as a child, you know, being a child of immigrants and coming here really young, it feels like you're being pulled in like two different directions, you know, specifically between the culture that you're being raised with at home and the one that your parents want you to have, and then the culture that you're being assimilated into and the culture that you're, you know, seeing in school, on TV, you know, just kind of like in everyday social settings. And I think for me specifically, the hardest times, you know, having that was growing up in middle school and kind of even high school as well, because at that time in middle school is when I first started wearing my hijab. And so that's when I was noticeably different than everyone else. Not everyone, but, you know, then like an average American or something like that. And so it kind of brought even more attention on me. And so that made it even a little bit more difficult. And at that time also was when you start kind of realizing that, oh, my parents are immigrants, or my parents aren't from this country, or, you know, my parents have an accent and things like that. And so I think things are also very much different than how they are now, because now I see that there's more kids are able to be more loud and more proud about the fact that they're, you know, children of immigrants or they're immigrants themselves and things like that. But I think, you know, when I was growing up, things were a little bit different and a little bit more difficult than it is now. But to kind of answer your question, I also think first generation immigrants, I would think that are those who are foreign born and then, you know, came to the U.S. That I think first generation Americans are just those that are naturalized now. And I personally like to identify as a first generation immigrant, although I know that there are like different terminology now, because I know there's like 1.5 or 1.75, you know, to identify those that came at a much younger age like myself. But I personally like to identify as a first generation immigrant, mainly because I feel like just adding the word immigrant to my identity kind of reminds me of who I am and what my parents and who my parents are, and the fact that, you know, my parents are the ones that came here and kind of started this journey for us.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, I see so many parallels, especially like I also started wearing the hijab in middle school. So I feel like before I wore that, people would know my last name was like foreign, but like being visibly foreign, and people kind of saw that I was different in a way, And then also during that period of time, you're really trying to figure out your identity and trying to fit in. I know I was in high school, especially, and adding immigrant to that was really important to me. I wanted to ask, so growing up or even now, when you get the question, where are you from? How do you answer it?
That's a really good question. So I think honestly, it depends on who I'm talking to. For the most part, because sometimes I feel like because I was born in Sudan, but I came here so young, it feels almost weird to kind of be like, oh, I'm from Sudan, but my entire life has like been in Greensboro. Like I've known, like, yeah, I've gone back to visit home several times, but I've known nothing except the U.S. for the most part, for literally my entire life. So it feels like almost weird, or like I'm like lying or something in some way if I say, oh, I'm from Sudan. But I from like recently, I think maybe in the past year or two, I've been more comfortable saying, oh, I'm from Sudan, but I grew up in the U.S., you know, but maybe if I'm like visiting a different state or something, I'm from Greensboro, but my family's from Sudan. So I think it kind of just depends on the context of the situation or who I'm talking to. But, you know, in any case, I always try to make sure that people know that even though I'm from Greensboro, North Carolina, I'm also, you know, I have ties, you know, elsewhere. So,
yeah, it's always like you have to make a very split second decision when someone asks you, like, do they want the whole backstory or do they just want I'm from Greensboro? And I've even run into times where like I've had someone ask me, like, where are you from? And I say, I'm from Greensboro. And then like a few minutes later in the conversation, we'll ask again, well, have you lived in Greensboro your whole life? And then I'm like, oh, so you want like the whole story then. So it's very interesting. And it's very interesting in like your own understanding of yourself, of how you answer that question.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so moving on to your life after high school, talk to me more about your path to your current role as a refugee community organizer. What drew you to this work and what challenges did you face along the way?
So I think this is going to be pretty lengthy. So after, so when I was in undergrad, I majored in religious studies and political science. And so kind of with my degree in political science and the time that I spent in that department specifically was really, those years were very important to me because they taught me a lot about, you know, how social change begins and kind of like specifically, I was always very interested in like how global social change begins. And then even more specifically, I was looking at like Sudan and like in African countries. And so that's kind of how my interest began there. And like just kind of generally trying to understand, you know, social movements and how, you know, those things happen and things like that. And then once I graduated, I, you know, took about a year and a half off, and then I went back for my master's degree in sociology. And at that time, the Sudanese revolution had began. Well, it began in December 2018 and ended, I think, around August 2019. But so my research during my master's program was really focused on how people get mobilized and then kind of like how social movements and social change create identity and things like that. And so for me, my I think a lot of my studies have always been, you know, kind of geared towards, you know, how does social change happen? How do people, how are people mobilized? How do people get one another to like, you know, how do people encourage one another to participate in things like this? And then one thing I also always have to credit also in a way is like the Sudanese community that I grew up in. And so like, as I mentioned earlier, you know, my dad came to, well, I don't know if I mentioned it, but my dad came to the U.S. Before the rest of my family. He came in 1997 and he lived in New York for the first 3 years before we came in. But he always heard that there was like a sizable population of Sudanese Americans living in Greensboro, or Sudanese people living in Greensboro. And fun fact, Guilford County is actually like the second largest Sudanese community after Fairfax County in Virginia. So that's pretty great. And so that's just something that I like to brag about. But so my dad, like I said, was just aware of the fact that there was a large Sudanese community here. And so he knew that, you know, for my mom to leave everything that she knew coming here to raise myself and my siblings was going to be very difficult for her. So he knew that one thing that would make it easier or maybe just kind of feel more familiar was having that large Sudanese community here. So that's why my dad made the decision to move to Greensboro. And, you know, I say that to say like this community really shaped me in, you know, a lot of different ways. And so the community, the Sudanese community, years ago started this thing called the Jalia, which is basically just a community association in Arabic. And the purpose of it is basically just to foster and continue the and help the Sudanese community hold on to their Sudanese identity and Sudanese culture here. And that's kind of and preserve the Sudanese culture. And that's kind of what's been going on for the past, you know, I want to say maybe I know it started much earlier, like maybe in the late 90s, but it didn't become more established until I think 2015, 2016. And so the association soon became known as Sudan House. And, you know, and so back in 2021, I was one of the youth program coordinators. And so kind of just being on that executive committee with 10 other people actually kind of really just showed me how much is possible when people come together and put their heads together and kind of be strategic and, you know, and just kind of really look out for their community and put the needs of their communities before the needs of themselves. And so that was really instrumental in the way that, you know, in the way that it influenced me in how I look at community and how I look at mobilization, how I look at collective power and things like that. And so, you know, spending the 2 years that I did with them really helped me with that and really helped show that to me, because during the 2 years that we were on the committee, we actually were able to purchase a building that, you know, serves as like the community center for the Sudanese community now. And so that was something that was really great, you know, just seeing that and being a part of it, of course, because I remember when I was, you know, being asked to join the committee, I was very scared, which I think is natural, very, very worried and just feeling like I wasn't going to be able to do the position justice. I wasn't going to be able to do what I needed to do. Like, how is it possible for me to try to get, you know, the youth in my community, which is a very difficult task, you know, to be more involved and, you know, in their community and things like that. But, you know, thankfully I finished my 2 years, which was, I think last month. So that was, so that's just one thing that's really helped me. But I think, yeah, I think just growing up in the community that I did, and my parents kind of always encouraged us to be involved in any way that we can, especially my mom. My mom is very big on, you know, social responsibility. And so she always calls it al-wajib, which basically translates to social responsibility. So my mom is really big on that. And so she always kind of planted those seeds in myself and my siblings. And I think that's just something that I continue to carry on with me. And so before this position, I was an employment specialist with CWS, and I did a lot of direct service with clients. And, you know, I kind of was able to notice the gaps that existed and how much I felt like refugees and immigrants really needed to be empowered in ways that were kind of out of my capacity as an employment specialist. And, you know, I think when the position opened, it was just like, I felt like that was the correct move for me at that time. And it was just a way for me to be able to continue empowering the community and, you know, helping them and, you know, and kind of, cause I don't necessarily believe in like being the voice of the voiceless, because everyone does have a voice. So it's just important to give people a platform and give them an outlet to be able to use those voices, because we're not always given the permission to use those voices. So I think it was just really important for me to begin my community organizing path, you know, to be able to give people the platform to use their voices.
Yeah, I like that, not being the voice for the voiceless, because everyone has a voice, but you know, not everyone's been giving the permission to use that. That's actually really powerful, because I hear that voice for the voiceless a lot, and I've used it myself too, but now I'm thinking there's a better way to frame that. So you said that you noticed there are gaps for refugees and immigrants that you noticed just as an employment specialist. Could you elaborate on some of those gaps?
Yeah, of course. So I think that like specifically when I look at like employment and stuff, like a lot of times like employers, you know, there's this lack of understanding or unwillingness to hire, you know, refugees. And so a lot of times I think our clients were, you know, kind of just like took that and were like, okay, well, that's fine. You know, but it was like, no, there's so much more that we can, myself as an employment specialist, there's only so much I can do, you know, in my capacity, because there's so many other clients that you have to make sure that are getting employed and are, you know, being self-sufficient, you know. And also, I think also understanding that self-sufficiency is not just being employed, but it's also being able to advocate for yourself, you know, and for your community. And I think that was the gap that I was noticing, is that, and of course, there's no blame on resettlement agencies. Of course, I think the work that they do is wonderful, but I think that's just, you know, having to understand that self-sufficiency also means, you know, being able to, you know, be fully integrated, which includes civic engagement, you know, advocating, community organizing, all of that is also part of being self-sufficient, and all that is also part of, you know, the full integration of refugees and immigrants in our communities. And I think that was just the biggest gap that was noticeable. And I, you know, when I learned more about the community organizing work that CWS does, I think that's when I realized this kind of fills that gap, or at least begins to fill that gap.
For sure. Self-sufficiency is such a big piece of the puzzle that a lot of people don't meet, because they think they can just stop at one, but you have to keep going. Sort of related to that, so thinking about civic engagement, and one of the biggest forms of civic engagement is connecting with local policy and lawmakers. Have you been involved in any initiatives to change policy for refugees and immigrants?
Yeah. So literally all the work that I do is based on, you know, helping refugees and immigrants become more, you know, be leaders in civic engagement, to be able to advocate for themselves and to advocate for or against, you know, policies that either hurt or help our community. And so I've done that through numerous ways. One was back in May, we attended, myself and some other refugee leaders, local refugee leaders, and then other leaders as well from different states, to be able to go to DC for Refugee Council USA's advocacy days. And so we were able to meet with our elected officials, you know, from our states, and be able to advocate for pro-refugee and pro-asylum legislation, such as, you know, the Afghan Adjustment Act, the New Deal for New Americans, and, you know, asking also for more funding for refugee resettlement, because that also, I think, would give refugee resettlement agencies even more capacity to be able to do more work that would benefit the refugee community. That's kind of the work that we've done, like, I want to say, like, at the federal level, but even here locally, you know. So like, a big part of my role is to make sure that refugees and immigrants are at the forefront of the work that we're leading, and it's not myself or anyone else picking the issues that are impacting the refugee and immigrant community, but it's that refugees and immigrants themselves are identifying the issues that are in their community. And so what we did back in December of 2022, we, you know, invited different refugee and immigrant leaders to come out and, you know, kind of like celebrate the year, but also plan for the next year and talk about what issues that they're seeing. So we do that through like issue identification and kind of like asking them, what is it that you're seeing in your community that you think needs to be addressed? And we were able to get a good list of things. And once the new year came along, we met again with these same leaders and others, and we were able to identify an issue that, one, people felt was winnable, and then also one that people felt was deeply felt by so many people within the community, not just one specific community or something like that, but it was one that we agreed that possibly the entire North Carolina community could agree on. And that was language equity at the North Carolina DMV. And so what we've been advocating for, and what we've been pushing for, and what we hope, you know, in the, you know, next couple of years we can achieve, is to be able to get more languages included on the North Carolina DMV permit test, specifically Swahili, French, Pashto, and Dari, because those communities are pretty large in North Carolina. You know, it's not just because of integration, but it's also a safety issue as well. And that's why it should be one that not only refugees and immigrants care about, but the entire North Carolina cares about, because it is one that's, you know, it is a safety issue. And we need to make sure that when people come to the U.S., you know, they're able to study and understand the driving, you know, laws here in their own language, and be able to take the test in their own language, because if they're not able to understand it and comprehend it, they're not understanding the laws. And it's very important for them to understand those laws. And then also to be able to drive, you know, it just helps in integration, because you need to go to work, you know, you need to go to a doctor's appointment, or, you know, just be able to attend everyday daily things by driving. And so that's one issue that we've been working on, or one policy effort that we've been leading, you know, with the help of, you know, refugees and immigrants, of course. And so I do have to say that we did find that there was a bill out, HB 275, that includes three other languages, Spanish, Khmer, and Chinese. And we want to include those languages with the other ones that I mentioned as well, you know, just to make sure that, you know, newcomers, when they come to the U.S., they feel fully integrated, and they're able to, you know, practice, you know, driving safety, of course, in North Carolina.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting that, because I know you have been working on that with the rest of the CWS team, this language access issue, which I've also noticed spreads to other areas outside of just the DMV, like, for example, civic engagement, like voting. So like voting education materials, going to the ballot box and not being able to understand what's written on the ballot. So I feel like that's something that can be applied to so many other areas. And like, starting with one specific issue is such a great grassroots like tool before moving on to other issues. Are there also ways that you think lawmakers and representatives can better reach out to immigrant communities? Because for me, when I think about lawmakers reaching out to their constituents, sometimes immigrants or foreign-born people are not included in those outreach efforts, for obviously because for one reason, a lot of them are still in that process of obtaining citizenship. But for those who do have citizenship, they are still turning out in lower numbers. And I wondered if you possibly had anything to say on that, or ways that that could be mitigated.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it is like a two-way street in a way. So I think for one, elected officials or lawmakers, like you said, you know, should be like directly reaching out to refugees and immigrants, you know, in their respective states, and specifically here in North Carolina. I mean, I think they should be going to these communities, you know, trying to understand, possibly making connections with, like, you know, service providers in the area, whether it be refugee resettlement agencies or post resettlement agencies, and, you know, asking how can we get connected to this community, you know, to be able to actually make those connections and not just like someone is somewhere up top just talking about our community, and yet no one is actually reaching out to our communities and trying to understand what is it that you need, or who are these people, you know, not even just what is it that you need, but who are refugees and immigrants in our communities in general. And I think the other part of that is that it's really important as well for naturalized Americans or naturalized citizens to go out and vote. I think that's like one of the biggest ways for us to make our presence known and to let lawmakers know that, hey, we're here. You know, we know that this is, because we know that our vote is our voice at the end of the day, and we know how much power we hold in that. And we know that we hold power over our elected officials because we're the ones who elect them in or out of office. And so it's important that us also, as, you know, refugees, former refugees and immigrants, you know, who have the ability to vote, to go out and vote, you know, kind of just to make our presence known and to let elected officials know that we're not going to just sit back and watch while you make these harmful policies or just don't address us at all. You know, we're going to let you know that we're here and that we're going to, you know, make sure that we exercise our right to vote. So I think it's definitely a two-way street in which, you know, elected officials have to do their part, but we also have to make sure that we're making our voices heard at the same exact time.
Yes, I agree 100%. That's something that I think is so personal to us both as, like, of immigrant descent, is that voting is something that is not always available in other countries. So when you come to the U.S. and you have something as powerful as a vote, taking advantage of that is just mind-blowing to me. I wanted to switch back to the topic of first-generation Americans and immigrants a little bit more, and asking you, growing up or just through your own journey as a change maker, what influence have you had from seeing other first-gen immigrants and other leaders in your community? Are there people that you're inspired by, people that you draw courage from?
Absolutely. And I also just want to touch back on the previous question as well, because I know that you mentioned, like, some countries being able to vote is not something that is easily accessible for a lot of people. And so I think another part of also, like, encouraging naturalized citizens to go out and vote is also voter education, you know, is making sure that there's that education piece as well, you know, informing the former refugee and immigrant community that, you know, here's how you vote, you know, here's where you can vote, here are the laws around voting, you know, here's why it's important to vote, you know, because, like you said, a lot of times people come from these countries in which they're not able to vote. And so it's kind of like not even a thing in their head for them to be able to be like, oh, I'm going to go out and vote on this specific election day. So yeah, I just kind of wanted to add that as well. In terms of people who I draw my courage from, I think first and foremost, of course, and it might be cheesy, but of course, my parents. I think those are just people that just their entire existence, I think, and their entire journey, you know, to coming to the US and being able to build a life here for me has been something that, even when I was working in direct service a lot, I was always, because when my family came here, I was very young, so I don't really remember the experiences that they had, but it kind of gave me, being able to work with directly with newly arrived refugees gave me kind of a glimpse into my own parents' lives when they first arrived to the U.S. and things. And so those are two people that I always am able to draw my courage from. And then I think specifically also, like, in my own Sudanese community, I know so many different women that are really, I feel like, in a society or in a culture that typically tries to hold us back, there's so many women in my community that are just out there and are just so strong enough to go out and, like, you know, start organizations or lead different movements or things like that. And so I think just women in general in my community are people that I always look to when I need motivation, or I need to be reminded of, you know, like, well, if they can do it, I can too. And it's not too difficult. It's not, I shouldn't give up. And then also, even the leaders that I work with as well are people that I draw courage from. I remember, I think it was about last month or the month before, I had met with a leader and I was telling her about our campaign and about language access in the DMV. And I was telling her how we had met a couple of weeks ago with a lawmaker who basically informed us that unfortunately the bill wasn't going to pass this session. And we were talking about it. And, you know, I think she could tell that I was feeling, you know, down about it. And like just the fact that she was able to comfort me and remind me of the work that we're doing. And I remember she said to me something along the lines of, we're planting these seeds now, but maybe we're not going to be the one to eat the fruit. Someone else will be able to eat it later. And I think just being able to be reminded of that by, you know, someone like by her was very encouraging. And it's something that I try to remind myself now. So those are, I think, just a range of different people that I'm able to get courage from that all remind me, you know, whether it be directly or indirectly of like, you know, no, you have to keep going that, and that this work is very long, but it's very worth it as well.
For sure. You're dropping so many good like phrases, like you plant the seeds, but you don't see the fruit. It's very true. This question just came to me, but thinking about myself as not only being someone from an immigrant background, but also being Black and also being a woman, and also being someone who's Muslim and wears the hijab, often like I don't see people who look like me in other spaces. And I struggle with imposter syndrome sometimes because I feel like, oh, well, do I even belong here? Or like I'm looking at all these people who came from such like privileged backgrounds. And I wondered if you ever struggled with imposter syndrome, whether it was in your academic career or your professional career, and if you had any words to say about that.
Absolutely. Definitely a lot in school, specifically during my 2 years of my graduate program. I definitely felt imposter syndrome so much that, to be honest, there was my second semester of graduate school, I was even considering like not completing it because of the imposter syndrome, because I just kept feeling like everyone there was smarter than me, or everyone there, they were just better than me. And what am I doing as a, like you said, a Black Muslim woman in this space? Like, what am I doing here? Like, I don't deserve to be here. And I think it just takes so much like mental work to have to continuously remind yourself, like, I do belong here. I do deserve to be here. I got here. I got here because I put in the work to get here. So I think that's one thing that I always have to remind myself. And it definitely got really difficult during graduate school, you know, because of that. And even like during the writing of my master's thesis. And like I said, it was the research that I did was primarily based on like social mobilization for social movements, specifically the Sudanese social revolution. I remember thinking like, you know, whenever I would meet with my advisor on it, I would just think like, you know, she probably thinks this is terrible. Like, this is absolute trash. Just like throw it away. And then and then she would like compliment it, or, you know, after she'd give me, you know, constructive criticism, she would also give me positive feedback and be like, oh, okay. You know, I guess it's not as bad as I thought it was. And I think just kind of every time I have those thoughts of like, oh, I'm not doing good enough, or this isn't, or my work isn't worth it, or you know, or I don't belong here, or I don't deserve to be here, kind of asking myself, what's the proof of those things that I'm saying, that I'm telling myself? And when I find that there is no proof of that, then no one has told me that you don't belong here. No one has said it to me like in that moment. It's like, oh, okay, then I should not believe that about myself, because I'm clearly here for a reason. So, but yeah, I definitely have felt that all the time.
Yeah, definitely. I had a mentor who once told me that those from backgrounds like ours often think less of ourselves. So when we hear someone like say something positive, it comes as a surprise to us. But realizing your worth is so important. It's something that I've learned in my internship, realizing that, you know, we're worth it. We were chosen to be here and we're passionate about it. Kind of segueing from that response that you gave, and also your background of working with young Sudanese people here, what are some ways that you think more first-generation Americans can get involved in the movement, specifically like young change makers? What ways do you think they could become more empowered?
Absolutely. So I think the first step would be understanding how much getting involved in the movement is a part of integration. Kind of like I said earlier, in that integration is a process that not only, of course, it includes social and economic integration, but also includes political integration as well. And I think it's really important. That would be the first step for first generation immigrants to understand that, you know, or change makers to understand that we need to be in this movement, because this movement impacts us. And so we need to be the ones leading it or taking the charge on it as well. And then I think after that understanding is that, especially in terms of like electoral power, our community is incredibly powerful, you know, and so not only is it important for the social integration of refugees and immigrants, or for, you know, first generation immigrants, but also, you know, it's important for us to be in these spaces because it helps us build community and it helps us create our communities that makes them stronger, makes our community stronger. And then also, I think another way to get involved or to, you know, be more empowered is by sharing your story. And I think that's something that's really important. And that's something I've always understood the importance of it, but it hasn't really fully registered or clicked in my head until I started, you know, community organizing, you know, in this formal way. And I remember like listening to a TED Talk years ago. It was called The Danger of a Single Story. And I remember the speaker just talking about, you know, the importance of the idea that a single story, you know, can lead to these false perceptions and misunderstandings of people in communities and things like that. And I think that's kind of where we are right now with the refugee and immigrant community. And so I think it's important that for us to amplify the messages of the directly impacted community, that we're not having anyone else speak for us, but that we're the ones speaking for ourselves, that we don't fall into the trap of the single story about the specific population. And so I think it's important that, you know, impacted community members, you know, first generation immigrants, to be able to share their stories and to advocate for themselves and for their communities. And then this may also include, you know, other ways would also include, like, after you share your story, you know, going out to vote, volunteering with local initiatives, you know, finding different organizations or different things that you care about to go out and, you know, contribute to them as well, you know, and then also learning how, you know, the local systems and government works, you know, not only, you know, like the federal government, but how does the state government work? How does your local government work? Things like that, I think, are all ways for first generation immigrants to get more involved in the movement and to continue, you know, leading it as well.
I definitely want to echo everything you said. That's so important. Sharing your story. I love that TED Talk. I've listened to it multiple times and I understand how important it is for, like, not only a single story of other people seeing you, their perceptions of you, and seeing that you, thinking that you have only a single story, but also think, realizing that you yourself, you don't have a single story. You, like, contain multitudes. You contain so many different backgrounds. And that's also so important. So yes, thank you so much for sharing everything. We're coming up on our final question. And this question, you can take any way that you want to, any way that you want to interpret it. So what do you think yourself as a first gen immigrant, or however you want to define yourself as an immigrant, bring to the table? What is something that only you feel that you bring to the movement?
I think going back to what that one leader I told you told me about planting seeds, I think that specifically my role in the movement is to plant those seeds. Now I see myself as kind of someone who's like pouring into other leaders to make sure that they're well prepared and they're also well equipped to share their stories, you know, and to continue the fight, kind of like we talked about earlier, you know, is that like we're not going to finish the fight now, but it's important to continue to plant those seeds now so that someone else can continue it and finish it later, and kind of understanding that it's not one that's ending soon. It's just something that's ongoing, and it won't just end with myself or local leaders, or it'll take all of us. So I think that myself, you know, as a first generation immigrant, also because I came here so young, I understand that I've enjoyed many privileges, thankfully, you know, specifically like my schooling, which is something that I know is not as easy for people who come here at an older age or something. So I know that that's one privilege that I've enjoyed. So I think my schooling coupled with the experience that I've had, you know, as an immigrant and watching my own parents navigate this country is what I bring to the table, I think. And I know that I want to be able, you know, to uplift the voices of the refugees and immigrants in my community, and, you know, whether it be through storytelling or even research, because research is something that I'm very passionate about as well. And I'm deeply passionate about, and I've thoroughly enjoyed doing it, like, all through my academic career. And so I think that that is what I'm able to bring to the table as a first generation immigrant, along with, you know, so many other people as well.
Thank you for sharing all of that. I very much am interested in the whole research thing, because realizing that academia is still a space that is not as diverse as it could be, having immigrants bring like research topics to the table that other people probably wouldn't have considered researching is so important. Yeah, like, for example, I'm very interested in like researching the intersection between politics and immigrant communities and seeing how those things like combine. So there's so many different topics that come out of our community that contribute to academia and community and policy and all these other great things. So that's everything I have for you today. Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, sharing the vulnerable parts of your journey, sharing your experiences, This has been very enlightening, and I think it will be so valuable for our listeners to have this new perspective to consider within the greater scheme of civic engagement. And just honestly, being a North Carolinian, this is stuff that we, North Carolinians, no matter where you're from, we need to learn about, because we're all from the same state and we all share in the same struggles.
Yeah, thank you so much, Zainab. And I'm really grateful that you had me on here and you're able to uplift the voices of so many, you know, of different people, you know, from different backgrounds. So I'm really grateful for that. And thank you again.
So I definitely want to talk about why this episode and its topic is important to me. I was born in North Carolina to immigrant parents from the West African country of Niger, just north of Nigeria. My parents became naturalized citizens while I was in elementary school, and as I grew up, they became increasingly involved in nonprofit and community work dedicated to immigrant and refugee rights and support. I saw firsthand the struggles that we as an immigrant community go through to be included in the conversation, the struggles we go through to fight various forms of xenophobia, racism, all while trying to fit in and integrate and hold on to our native culture. That is a lot of things to balance. And trying to balance all of that while also figuring out my own identity in high school was a really big deal to me and a really good opportunity for self-reflection, and is what kind of steered me to wanting to be in these types of spaces and doing this kind of work where I'm fighting for fair access, whether that be voting access or just access for immigrant communities to be represented in other spaces.
I hope you enjoyed this episode and took away some new perspectives about the immigrant experience within the greater civic engagement and social change movement. And as always, thank you for helping us to create a North Carolina that's built by us.